Hello, and welcome to Lean and Mean, presented by Comfort Dental, where we help dentists learn how to truly own their own practice. I'm your host, Judy, here with the president and founder of Comfort Dental, Dr. Rick Kushner. Dr. Kushner, how are you today?
Doing just great. Thank you, Judy.
Can we explore those five priorities you mentioned in your practice? Could you walk us through them and explain how they shape the patient experience?
Sure. So our practice revolves around five key priorities. The first is offering quality care as if the patients were family.
Love that.
Second, of course, we aim to avoid causing discomfort. Third, we make a commitment to see every patient on time. Fourth, being paid for our services is essential. And fifth, we emphasize the importance of continuing care. Yes, we don't overemphasize that. I've touched on that before. It's the right thing to say. It's the right thing to do. I just don't want to overemphasize that. So now to tie it all together, we strive to achieve these priorities cost efficiently and in a pleasant, relaxed manner.
Yeah, that checks out. Those are certainly crucial aspects of patient care. How do you ensure you stick to these priorities, especially the commitment to seeing every patient on time?
Well, that's a tough one for dentists, but it comes down to a mental commitment on my part. I make sure that I see every patient on time, even if it's just to pop my head in and say, I'm here, I'll be right with you. And we have regular staff meetings every few months to grade ourselves on these priorities and these types of things. It's a continuous process of self-evaluation to ensure we're meeting our goals.
That's great. So an evaluation every so often, that's a great approach. Now, can we talk about appointment failures? You mentioned that you don't scold or charge for missed appointments. How do you handle these situations to maintain a positive patient relationship?
Well, certainly appointment failures can be a bit aggravating, but we never scold the patient. Instead, we reach out to express our disappointment, offer to reschedule, and make sure the patient knows we still want them in the practice. It's about maintaining communication without scolding, and we found that it helps in retaining patients even after multiple failures. It always drives me to a side story. Comfort Dental, Lean and Mean, we've been open Saturdays for decades, and I've heard dentists thousands of times say, oh, we don't like Saturdays. The patients always cancel. They never show up. I'm going to tell you, Judy, Saturdays are so busy, we hope they cancel. But that helps us in retaining patients, even after multiple failures.
Yeah, that's a compassionate approach. That would work for me. Can we move on to post-op phone calls that you mentioned? You highlighted the importance of making these calls personally instead of using, you know, text or anything like that. Can you share more about why you believe this personal touch is crucial?
Sure, the post-op care call. Making post-op phone calls personally adds a human touch to the patient experience. Hearing from the doctor? Are you kidding me? We focus on patients who received injections, and we check in on their recovery. And it's a simple, how's our tooth doing after a couple hours, type of conversation that strengthens the bond between the patient and the dentist and our practice.
A thoughtful gesture. And you mentioned having a care list. How does this list help in providing additional support to patients after very specific operations and procedures?
As an offshoot of the post-op care call, we've developed what we kind of refer to as a care list. The care list is designed for patients who may need a follow-up call, let's say 3, 4, 5 days after a certain procedure, like a difficult wisdom tooth or some new bridge work or some new implants, that type of thing. We know doctor's going to check in with the patient that very evening. It's an extra step to ensure their comfort and address any concerns they might have during this initial several-day, let's say, recovery period. We know that the patient won't get completely comfortable and accustomed to these types of things in just a few short days. When in doubt, make a call. I've never once had a patient leave my practice because we were too concerned. Now, having said that, I think it's only fair to say, I've had patients every now and then, we love each other. Patient said, I'm fine, doc. Stop worrying about me. I'll call you if I need you.
Patient relationship that you build upon and establish and is super personal, aligns with their needs, that's commendable. Can we touch on patient retention? The face-to-face approach for patients considering leaving the practice is what I mean. How does the patient exit interview work in practice?
When a patient expresses the desire to leave, we invite them in for a face-to-face conversation. What'd we do wrong? Drop in and talk to me about it. I want to fix this. We ask about any issues they may have and try to address them immediately. We apologize, of course, promise to rectify any problems, and assure them that their concerns will be discussed in a staff meeting to prevent a recurrence. However, we do leave the door open for them to return, emphasizing that we value their relationship with our practice.
That's thorough and considerate, and a great way to approach handling patient concerns, but do they always express the desire to leave out of curiosity? Is that part feels difficult to me. How do you know?
They don't always express that desire. It's usually silent, ask for records transfer, that type of thing. But if we know, we're going to make this contact.
Nice.
Very often, no, I'm not coming in. Can I talk to you on the phone for a few minutes? We'll do it on the phone if we have to. I'd rather do it in person.
Nice. Now let's switch gears a bit. You mentioned sending out holiday greetings during less common months. Could you elaborate on the reasoning behind this unconventional strategy?
Sure. Sending holiday greetings during less common months sets us apart. It's just kind of silly making a personal connection outside of New Year's or the typical Christmas holiday season. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe it's Valentine's Day, President's Day, April Fool's, Cinco de Mayo, that type of thing. It's just a way to stay connected with our patients in a more memorable manner.
That's creative. I love that. And it's engaging throughout the year. And finally, you touched on the importance of having someone dedicated to patient relations. Can you share more about the role of this specialist and how it contributes to the overall efficiency of the practice?
Yes, I would like to. It's a creative way to stay engaged with your patients. A patient relations specialist plays a crucial role in handling various tasks, from new patient thank yous, kind of controlling that, managing that, making sure doctors on top of that, to managing the care list and the post-op calls. Having someone dedicated to these responsibilities ensures that stuff doesn't fall through the cracks. It allows the dentist and the rest of the staff to focus on providing the quality care while still maintaining that personal touch.
I love it. Somebody to keep you organized and keep everything from falling through. Dr. Kushner, I think lots of people are tempted to take bits and pieces of the info that you're providing here. Can you expand upon why it's important to take the comprehensive approach?
I sure hope to help you see why we try to suggest strongly that you implement as much of the total lean-amine system as possible, because the effectiveness of one technique is dependent on how well you accomplish the previous technique.
Mm-hmm.
And everything builds on the foundation you previously established, and everything's tied together. So we use the, I don't like overemphasizing the emergency office call, but I'm going to use it as an example. We use the emergency office call as a feed-in to new patient exam, not into treatment. We've discussed that in past episodes. In the purest sense of the system, you should have no patients in your practice, none, who have not been through your complete examination, because you don't have treatment or hygiene visits unless you've had your diagnosis. And you don't have your diagnosis unless you've had your complete new patient exam. Now, to completely finish up this flowchart, the same concept of conversion applies to the after-hours emergency call, although we handle it quite differently.
It's all connected, you're saying?
Yes.
But no patients. That all sounds alarming to a lot of practices. But with the lean and mean system, it makes sense. New patients and how they're treated are just as important. And I know Comfort Dental is also open on evenings and Saturdays, like you mentioned. Can you speak to how that's helped set you apart from competition?
Sure. I've always encouraged the after-hours emergency. It's been a tremendous practice builder over the years. You wouldn't believe how many families we've gotten over the years because their doctor couldn't be bothered on Saturday evening or Sunday morning. So we believe in being available. Our home phone numbers are placed on the office recordings, and patients are encouraged if necessary, to call the doc or the on-call doc at home after hours.
Wow.
I'm talking about a very specific category of patient. A stranger, someone we've never heard of, after hours. They'll call and we say, yes, we would be available for an after hours call if necessary. And the charge will be X dollars, whatever you decide it should be. $100, $200, $300, $500. And then the regular fee schedule for whatever we do beyond that. And then we'll collect that money on the way in. This is the only instance that we volunteer to mention money over the telephone prior to a first visit. And we do mean cash, by the way, in these instances. And again, I'm thinking about safety for the doctor and the staff member that might appear with him or her.
Right.
No checks, no charge card, no insurance forms. We do all those the next day during regular office hours. You can apologize later on for the harshness of your policy, but reasonable people will understand.
Cash only sounds tough, but if you follow up with apologies and understanding and say it's policy for several reasons, I see how that works. So what's the next step?
Julie, we further tell the patient that we need the make and license number of their automobile so that we can notify the police of the cars that'll be in our parking lot after hours. We actually do that. But whether we do or not, I would say that you're going to do that. But whether you do it or not, say so. If you follow these steps, you'll help people who truly need your help. And once again, you can apologize for the harshness of your policy after you meet these folks. You'll help them, you'll build your practice, and you'll keep yourselves from getting burned financially or worse. So I hate to overemphasize the after-hours emergency, but there's a safety issue here, and I don't want to lead our young docs down the wrong path.
It's always important to cover your bases, especially for safety. Are there any exceptions to some of these guidelines?
If the patient goes to all the aggravation of the after hours and the cash, I might go ahead and take the tooth out, do the extraction, rather than just medicate. But the whole point of this discussion is, even in this case, as in all cases, we try to not let the patient out the door without scheduling the next visit. It's always policy, whether it's back for a recall, continuing care, complete exam, more treatment. No patient in the purest sense should leave the practice without another appointment.
Of course. Getting them in and getting them back, both important.
We've gotten some tremendous cases from the after-hours emergency, and we've used it as a practice builder.
You never really know where or who those cases are going to come from, so it's worth taking all of them, is what you're saying. Back to the cash-only deal. What are the exceptions here?
Well, it should be obvious that an exception to the cash policy would be a patient that's already a patient of record, a patient we're familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
Patient of record in the middle of treatment, patient that we're familiar with, patient of record will not need to go back through a complete new patient exam unless it's been several years, and then that gets to be a gray area. Which side of the fence are we going to put that kind of patient on?
Hmm.
But that patient may already have a complete exam.
Right. You already have a relationship with this patient, and there's a trust there. Any other lookouts you keep an eye out for?
As an example, and again, just thinking from a safety standpoint here, I don't want to lead any young docs astray. Beware of the patient that's in a big hurry to get all of his or her dentistry done very quickly.
Mm.
Slow down. This has happened repeatedly. Make sure everything's in order. Reconfirm insurance eligibility. Let's again slightly more formally list the reasons why. And we've discussed this slightly. We want to resist first visit prophy's. Prophy's kind of like a haircut. There's a psychological sense of finish to it.
Hmm.
We don't want the patient to have that sense of finish until we've had a chance to complete or at least present all of his or her dentistry. We very often, in a healthy periodontal mouth, sequence the prophy last, not first, last in the treatment plan. Secondly, we've kept statistics. I think I have mentioned this in a previous session with you, Julie, and it's been 3.2 years on the average since the last prophy, cleaning for our new patients. So we're not going to ask our hygienist. I'm not going to hack away. Our hygienist is not going to hack away at three-year-old calculus for an hour for a single, for a single prophy fee. We're also not going to allow our hygienist to stop in the middle and invite the patient back so that she or he can finish without having all this pre-diagnosed and pre-arranged financially.
Mm-hmm.
Thirdly, without having examined the patient, we don't know how much time to allow for hygiene. Hmm. Every dentist knows there are 20-minute prophys and there are 2-hour and 20-minute scaling and root planings.
Hmm.
Fourth, if we add a prophy to the other things that we ordinarily like to do on that first visit, i.e. the complete exam, full series of films, panel if that's your thing, maybe study models if appropriate, perio workup if appropriate, if we add the prophy to that, I don't like the first visit fee that's building. We're into hundreds of dollars.
Right.
Fifth, we like to invite new patients in same day or next day. Our hygiene schedule is not always as flexible as doctors' production schedule to have 1-hour openings available on a daily basis. Yet we do try to make time to work in at least several of the shorter new patient exam or emergency office call patients on a short notice. So that should clear up a lot of the reasoning for no first visit prophys, or at least resisting them. If you're committed to not doing or resisting first visit prophys, you've established a terrific foundation for tripling your hygiene department and for also tying up your appointment control. And most importantly, firming up your collection policy.
So to recap, 1, slow down. 2, how long has it been? 3, exam first. 4, figure out the extent of services. And 5, scheduling. What else?
Sure, Judy. Consider whether or not this might be a fair statement. Many dentists produce a lot of dentistry and then complain to their office staffs for under-collecting. I'm going to suggest that maybe these staff people are not under-collecting, that maybe these doctors are overproducing.
Interesting.
Overproduction is production of dentistry that cannot be collected for in a reasonable length of time and in a reasonable fashion. This system is designed to completely eliminate open accounts in the practice. Open accounts in a dental practice are crap. The mechanics are simple, but the mental conviction, the fortitude to live by the system is going to be a different matter.
So you're saying no open accounts, no overproducing.
Correct. Once again, the real skill will be, can you refuse elective service when the finances are not in order and still keep that patient in the practice? It'll work with your patients. Mine are no different than yours. It's another big thing dentists like to say. Oh, my patients are different than yours. No, they're not. You needn't sacrifice your high gross production for a high collection rate. If you cannot bring yourself to implement these changes on your existing patients, that's even a little more understandable. Start with your new patients.
New patients, a common theme. How do you go about collecting payments and making sure you don't have these open accounts?
Now you really want to get into it, don't you, Judy? We don't send statements. We hope to send none.
Huh.
And our patients do not think of us as a cash practice. We're not a cash practice. You don't need to settle for a 95% collection rate, even though that's considered acceptable by the so-called experts over the decades, for a high-volume practice, or high-volume practices such as all of ours. You can have 100-plus percent collections.
100-plus? How does that work?
It's going to get a little complicated, so an apology in advance.
Math.
In a 50% overhead practice, an increase in collection rate from 95%, which the so-called experts usually tell us is acceptable for high-volume practice, to 103%, which I'm telling you is feasible.
Hmm.
That increase results in a 17.8% increase in the net income. That's doctor's income, your net. Net profitability, not your gross. There's no mystery to it. We collect lots of fees in advance of treatment. If you consistently collect for dentistry prior to producing it, you end up collecting more than you produce. If you on a consistent basis collect for dentistry prior to producing it, you end up collecting more than you produce. We like a reverse accounts receivable. We like to owe our patients money. As a matter of fact, ideally, our accounts will show more positive balances. That's credit balances on account than negative ones actually in the hands of our patients.
I would say how, but you just explained it. So instead, I guess I'm going to say wow.
We do maintain accounts receivables of between 50 and 100% of a month's collection. Our goal is, let's say, 50 to 75%, one half to roughly two thirds or three quarters of a month's production collection. But 95% of that is outstanding insurance claims, not in the hands of our patients. So we're talking about a minority here through all of this detail. So again, we advocate an accounts receivable in the one half to two thirds or three quarters of a month's production. The last thing I want to do is send a statement. They're counterproductive. I sincerely believe that sending a statement is an invitation to the patient to not pay off the entire balance.
A request for payment is an invitation not to pay. That's interesting.
I believe that. How long do you think your patient would keep going to work if his or her paycheck got smaller every month, or if it stopped coming altogether? We believe, and this is just as an aside, think about the hard costs now. We believe that the tens of thousands of dollars that we've saved over the years by physically not sending statements. I'm just talking about the costs saved by physically not processing postage, mailing, and so on and so forth. Sending statements has paid for all of our marketing. The dollars we've saved by not processing and sending statements has paid for all of our marketing, which is directly productive rather than counterproductive, and still left us tens of thousands of dollars profit. And again, repeating myself, I'm just talking about the hard costs, physical costs saved by not producing and sending statements, not to mention the resulting improved collection rate.
So no processing or sending statements. How do you make sure you collect? Do you have a collection policy?
Collection policy is an absolute thing. You either have one or you don't. I only belabor the point because most practices that I see to this day have no collection policy. They have what they might call a collection policy, but I call it a billing policy. To me, there's a huge difference.
And that difference is?
Billing policy, you know, I mean the 30-day statement, the 60, the 90-day, the friendly reminder, the second reminder, the final reminder, the collection attorney out of your practice, but no collection policy. You might say, well, great, we don't want those kind of patients in our practice. Segmenting patients into those you want and those you don't want, that's a dangerous business, and collection policy is another way to get into that trap. We need a system to weed our practice of those deadbeats anyway. No, we do not. We want those patients in our practice because we would rather not do the elective dentistry and keep the patient in our practice than do the elective dentistry and risk losing the patient by hounding them for payment after treatment right out of the practice.
It's that theme of it's not the patient, it's how you treat them.
Sure, and we could all start doing $1 million, $2 million a year tomorrow in dentistry if we just did all the dentistry that walked through the door and then sent statements for it. And we might be able to collect maybe half of it, maybe even two-thirds. But it wouldn't take us long to go bankrupt. So you might say, gee, isn't there a dichotomy here, Dr. K? I mean, you're a positive proponent, a big proponent of positive patient relations, and then you have this hard-nosed collection policy. Isn't there a contradiction here? No, I don't think so. In the first place, it's not a hard-nosed collection policy. It's firm, but it's fair, and it's all in how it's packaged and handled. I think the hard feelings come when the elective dentistry's done and we hound for payment. When it's all tied up neat and tidy in advance, and you know what? They like the dentistry better too. The dentistry is much more satisfactory when it's paid for.
So payment in advance, and you get what you pay for, or so they say.
I like the way you said that. The lean and mean policy for elective dentistry cases, over a certain dollar amount that we'd like to offer, we'd like you to offer three choices. I said over a certain dollar amount, so let's get that straight in our heads. Maybe it's as little as $300 or $400 or $500. $1,000 is a nice number to work with. It might be $2,000 in your practice. And it's going to vary from practice to practice. But I want to slow down and let you just think of where this cutoff is going to be that you're going to offer these three choices. Well, let's say it's little. Let's say it's $300. We're going to offer our patient these three choices. We're back in the diagnosis visit. Mm-hmm. I'm quoting one fee with no breakdown. I'm not offering an itemization. We talked about this now. Itemizations create shoppers, and it gives the patient ammunition to take to the next dentist. And not only is he ready to beat your fee, what else does he want to do? He wants to criticize your dentistry in front of the patient. Because if I make more money than him, I taught you this. He's a better dentist than me. Remember that law?
Oh, gosh.
So again, as you recall from the diagnosis, I've told them how long it will take. I've explained how much it won't hurt. And I saved how much it will cost for last. And remember, we're working with the copayment most often, by the way. Most of these are insurance cases.
Right.
So this is much rarer than I'm leading you to believe. So I've saved how much it will cost for last, because if I do that any earlier, they tend to not hear anything else that I have to say. Let's say we're working with our patient, Jim. And let's say it's $1,000 worth of dentistry, and I'll give them a present patient similar to this. We're back in the diagnosis visit, and I'm quoting one fee with no breakdown. I'm not offering an itemization. Itemizations create shoppers, and it gives the patient ammunition to take to the next dentist.
Right.
We're quoting one fee with no breakdown. And again, if it's an insurance case, we're only working with the copayment. So this is much rarer than I'm leading you to believe. And again, as you recall from the diagnosis, I've told them how long it will take. I've explained how much it won't hurt. Cost, comfort, convenience. I've saved how much it will cost for last. Because if I do that any earlier, they tend not to hear anything else that I have to say.
Right.
So let's say we're working with Jim. And it's not $300, it's $1,000 worth of dentistry. And I'll give a presentation similar to this. Jim, with treatment the size of yours, we offer all of our patients three choices, hoping to help you afford your dental care. The first is, if you should have the funds available, either personally or through your own source, we can offer you an 8% discount for payment as we begin your treatment. If you can't do that, we love you just the same. But a lot of our patients do take advantage of this by using either their charge card or their credit union. Or maybe you got $1 million buried in your backyard, Jim. I don't know. But if you can do that, your savings would be, and of course, in this fictitious example I'm giving you, that would be $80. That's 8% if you're using an 8% pre-treatment discount. Mm-hmm. That 8% is not written in stone. Back to Jim. Mm-hmm. Remember, Jim, in order to qualify for your discount, we'll need the total amount paid as we begin your treatment. Now, that was option number one.
Love that.
I used 8%. Doesn't have to be 8. Maybe it's 5. Maybe it's 10. Maybe it's 12. That was option number one. Mm-hmm. Your second choice, Jim, is that we can arrange the total for you, interest-free, for 12 months. We do use a billing company, and you need to fill out credit information, but you can do all of that right here in our office. We'll call it in, and if you're approved, your monthly payment will simply be, in this $1,000 case divided by 12 payments, it would be $83.33 a month. 1/12 of the total on the $1,000 case. It's not actually interest-free, Jim, but it's totally interest-free to you because we pay the interest for you. If for any reason you're not approved, I don't want it to affect your and my relationship. We'll just try to find another way for you to afford your dentistry. Your third choice then, Jim, is to be on a pay-as-you-go basis. I do not prefer this honestly because all too often it slows down treatment and it can compromise the results. But Jim, if we need to restore one tooth per year for the next 20 years in order to keep you in my practice, I'll do it that way. You're that important to me.
That's great. Options are great. People respond well to options. And you present them in an order that isn't just best for you as a dentist or as a practice, but that's best for the patient too.
Yes, thank you. And so again, to repeat, 8% pre-treatment discount. And again, I'm repeating, the 8% is somewhat arbitrary. Maybe 10, maybe you think 5's enough. Second option, 12 months or 1 year interest-free. Third option, payment per visit. Mm-hmm. None of them say anything about sending a statement. Everyone without an arrangement for a larger case via one of these three options, larger case, we're using $1,000 for the example, could be a copayment though. So without an arrangement for a larger case via one of these three choices gets approached to the time of service. By the way, any payment due on the appointment day, we're not too shy about finding a polite, discreet way to ask for it on the way in. Not just at the time of service, but on the way in. Any forgotten checkbooks or other baloney, sometimes they can just go home. With our system, we've been open and honest. We've explained what we intend to do in advance. They've made a commitment to us, or they wouldn't have been scheduled in the first place. So if they fail their commitment, we just may not perform and we do not feel guilty. Mm-hmm. We feel that in all but extreme hardship situations, and we've all done, and I do, and I have done tons of free dentistry. I'm not talking about that. In all but extreme hardship situations, patients can come up with $100 or a couple hundred dollars or so for elective dentistry.
I mean, that sounds completely fair. Again, you get what you pay for. If you're paying nothing, then that's what you're getting.
So one more repetition. Cases under the arbitrary cutoff point, strictly cash, check, or charge card, no other arrangements. Your patients can afford it. If not, they might not be candidates for elective dentistry. Mm-hmm. So back to the three choices on the larger amounts, which will be the bulk of your collection policy. I'm still amazed daily at how many patients take advantage of the pre-treatment discount. But you gotta offer it. Americans are bargain-oriented. Use that to your advantage. Of the three choices, this is my prediction for you. This will be the overwhelming favorite.
I mean, personally, I think that's what I would go for too, if I had the leeway to do that. Is this the option that you push for? And how does that affect your overall overhead?
Now, I'm not going to ask you to sacrifice full fee services in order to do discounted services. I don't mean that. That can be considered kind of silly. But if you seriously play around with your overhead, you'll be surprised at how it works. You may argue about me, and this is not unfair. I'm with you. Sure, they collect more than 100%, but a lot of it is discounted fees, so it's not really 100% collection. You'd be right. I couldn't argue. But I would respond that we make up the difference in other ways. For example, maybe aggressive treatment planning, such as perhaps with the hygiene department, as we've touched on slightly, or through the use of a contingency fee, something that maybe might come up. I really haven't done much of that. I'm not saying we do a lot of that, but we all have some services that we don't ordinarily charge extra for. Maybe we will in some of these cases. Some dentists might charge extra for an anesthetic or a nitrous oxide. We really do not charge for those things. But if you need to do that to make up the difference, I won't argue with you.
And you also mentioned saving money on the statements and physically sending out billing statements, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So you're making up the difference, but only on charges for specific things.
Sure, and raise a couple of fees if you need to pad your treatment plan. Again, no argument, but we really don't do much of that. But if it makes you more comfortable, if you can raise some fees without meeting resistance, I don't think we can do that these days as easily as we have in the past, frankly. But if that's what it takes, okay, no argument from me. A little different slant. If I give, say, an 8% pre-treatment discount on a $1,000 case, I'm not only collecting 92% of my fee, 920 then becomes my case fee. So in the charge column, it's zero. In the paid column, and of course, we all have computers that do all this for us these days, but back in the day when it was paper, in the paid column, it's $920. And over here in the accounts receivable column, it's a $920 credit balance. Credit. And we work that off as the patient comes in. As the patient comes in and gets the services completed. That $80 is gone with the wind. But it may have been compensated for somewhere in the treatment plan.
So the price of the service is no longer $1,000. It's $920, which is 100%.
You got it. Correct. Another thing to remind you, and I've said this before, the presentation sounds as though we do this on every single case and every single patient and every single service. So most of the time we're talking about a copayment here, not the total case. Mm-hmm. We're only discounting the copayment portion of this case. So again, for example, if dental insurance is picking up, let's say, 60% of a particular case, and we're offering an 8% pre-treatment discount on the remaining 40%, 8% of 40% is only 3.2% of the total fee.
Hmm.
One more. Let's say we have a $2,200 case with some phenomenal insurance, or say two phenomenal insurances, maybe a couple, husband, wife type of thing. And the insurance, or the two of them, is going to pick up 2,000 of the 2,200, leaving a $200 copayment out of 2,200. I would let that patient pay $1 a month for 200 months if he wanted to. I mean, I'm not going to jeopardize, and dentists don't get this, I'm not going to jeopardize my $2,000 insurance payment for the $200 copayment. It's less than 10%.
Mm-hmm.
That's an exception to the policy that most of us with all good common sense would make. It sounds great to get all your money, but I have no doubt that to demand full payment from an insurance patient greatly reduces the average size of the case. So we accept assignment. And in spite of all the difficulties carriers give us, and they do, and it's getting worse, it gets worse all the time, I still prefer 95% of my accounts receivable in the hands of insurance companies as opposed to in the hands of our patients.
It's a smart way of thinking. I agree 100%, or at least 95%. I'm looking forward to continuing this conversation, but unfortunately, that's all the time we have today. Thank you so much.
The pleasure's mine. Thank you, Judy.
And thank you, listeners, for tuning in. Until next time.